Sending flowers has always been the best way to show someone you care. But if you're the one doing the sending, it isn't always easy or satisfying. You're lured in with a $19.99 advertised price, and when you check out, it's $94, and you're asking, what exactly just happened? There are hidden fees that leave you with a big bill, and even bigger disappointment when your flowers show up looking different than the pictures and only last but a few days. Books.com is a better way to buy flowers. The Books company offers fully transparent pricing, an easy, affordable shopping experience, and an incredible curated selection of flowers starting at $40, including free delivery. Each book is sustainably farmed and comes straight from grower to customer, meaning your flowers last longer and cost less to buy. This year, show every mom in your life you care with flowers from the Books company. And here's a special offer for my listeners. Order now and get 20% off. Hurry up. Flowers will sell out, so don't wait. Just visit Books.com and enter code WOJ for 20% off your Mother's Day purchase. That's BOUQS.com, code WOJ at checkout. Hey, everyone. Welcome into the Vertical Podcast with WOJ. My guest today, here in sunny Santa Monica, California, two-time NBA championship coach and very possibly the 2017 NBA Coach of the Year, Miami's Eric Spoelstra. Stay with us. Here in LA with Heat coach Eric Spoelstra. Spo, how are you?
Good. Thanks for having me on.
Spo, this time of year for you, and you were 9 years as head coach, you've missed the playoffs twice. This is the second time. Your body, and most years you've been in the playoffs, you've made pretty deep runs. How does your body, how does your head decompress when there's part of you saying, I should be, normally, I'm in my bunker right now, I'm preparing, we're playing, and then it's just over, and you have to sort of walk back from a season. Does that take some adjustment?
It does. And you have a time clock, in the NBA, and we've been fortunate enough to have some success, even before that, obviously, as an assistant, that, you do start to, expect your season to extend. But you do it, also with the perspective of knowing how damn hard it is. So this league is unforgiving. It doesn't wait for you. It just ends. Even when you feel that you have an opportunity to keep on going, we felt with the team that we had, if we could just squeak in the playoffs, we thought we would have an interesting, team and give teams, a tough run at it. And we're always wired to think that we have a chance. So even with this team and when it ends so abruptly and not given that chance, it is tough. And you just have to be able to get out of town. I think when you stay in town, it's okay. Tougher to decompress. It's tough to manage all that. It's tough to turn on the TV and watch, you know, the first round. By the time it gets to the second round, you've healed a little bit and you're able to start watching games.
Two NBA finals you didn't win, and I'm sure you leave with great regret. Your organization's always been about chasing championships, and that's the standard. And so even in your last press conference when this team didn't qualify for the playoffs, the emotion, it almost seemed as for this team and this group that you wanted to get into that postseason as much as just to get that group into the playoffs, as much as you may have wanted to get those other teams' titles or help, you know, go the distance with those groups. Was it a comparable feeling?
I don't know necessarily if you can compare emotions from different years, different challenges. But I'll tell you what, this team affected all of us in such a special way. And I think sometimes this league, for the right reasons, is result-based. And we're all here and paid to produce a result. It is really competitive, and sometimes you don't have opportunities to really face adversity and be given a chance to develop persistence and fortitude. And for this group to be able to do that, to be able to be pushed all the way to the brink, and it could either go from where we were to tank, or fight for your lives and fight all the natural human conditions. Mm-hmm. And it would be totally normal to start to think the worst. and players or staff to start thinking about, okay, this isn't going to happen. But this group had great resilience, great toughness, and it was really developed from a lot of that adversity. And it was one of the more special years that I've ever been a part of, because we had that opportunity to collectively get to know each other under extreme circumstances, to fight our way back from the depths of hell, to develop that persistence, and we came out better for it. The experience from it. Look, we're hardwired to compete for championships, but it's not always going to work out that way. It is so tough and so competitive in this league. That doesn't mean you can't have great memories and experiences. This team, even though it never made the playoffs, they'll have a bond. You know, even years from now, when we go through our NBA circles and we see each other, it'll be, oh yeah, we went through that together, and they'll be able to have that with each other. They'll remember this year. I think that's special. And sometimes you have to celebrate those mini victories, even though it isn't necessarily what you ultimately want out of it.
You've had a little time to reflect on the season. Did this team teach you anything? Do you walk away saying they taught me or reaffirmed something to me about what it is I do, about what we're all trying to do here?
Well, there's been so much of dialogue and narrative about culture, and that's really league wide. That's pro sports wide. And then what happened with this team? There's been a lot of narrative about culture. I think first we all gained something by going through this experience together, and even a lot of us that have had some success, with other teams, mm-hmm. to be able to go through that with this team. We all learned what it was like to really be down in the depths and find a way to dig out of it. And I think we'll all benefit from that. So I learned a lot from this team. I learned a lot about persistence and grit. And I think each player learned something from that, and staff members did. But that word culture, sometimes it just gets thrown out mm-hmm. there.
Gets thrown out there a lot.
Yeah, it does. Our culture, I think if you just set it out there around the league, most people know what we stand for. Mm-hmm. For better or worse, our culture, we don't feel necessarily that we're saying it's better than anybody else's. We just believe in it. And you could say that we stand for world class, best conditioned, hardest working, most professional. There's also probably some punchlines to our culture. We get it. We feel pretty comfortable about who we are. We're not for everybody. We're not perfect. Neither is everybody else. And their organizations is something that we believe in, though. We try to make it better. We've tried to evolve it. We've tried to make it more contemporary to today's athlete. But we do feel strongly in our culture, and we feel that we can help players achieve their dreams. We feel that we can create an environment where we can help teams reach their full potential and hopefully compete for championships. But it's something you have to constantly work on. And when we say culture, it does mean those things. It does mean family. It does mean something that we will fight for. We know that it's a constant evolution, because everybody else is developing their cultures as well. And ours has been around for 22 years. I think the vision that Mickey and Pat had really is astounding. And to be able to have that thought that many years ago, and to be able to sustain it for this long with so many different players coming through here, different staff members, different head coaches, mm-hmm. Different scouts. Most of us have been around for the 22 years. But that vision is something that's really remarkable in pro sports.
When you're 11 and 30, and there's a lot going on in an organization, when a team looks like it's headed for the lottery, do we start selling off pieces? Do we just say, okay, we're tanking, and we're going to see what value we can get for these guys? We're not going to do anything really to improve the team. And there's that going on. That conversation's going on in an organization. And then you're looking at the little things day to day that, like when losing can breed selfishness, guys like, I'm going to just play to try to get, I'm a free agent this summer. I'm going to try to get some numbers. When you were 11:30, did it feel like a contaminated 11:30, or just, we aren't good enough, but I think we can play better? Or did you feel like you were trying to clean anything up with the group?
I didn't. And I think that speaks to the character of each player. So many of the players started to coin this phrase that they come from the jungle, and that really was a compliment to the journey that each player had gone on to get to this point to be a part of this team. So many of them came from the D League, overseas, kicked around, people had given up on them, but they found a place where they felt like, hey, people believe in us. There might be an environment where I can be who I've always hoped I could be. So even when we were losing, there were a lot of moving parts that weren't necessarily excuses, right, but it made it feel like, hey, things are going along the right track. Now, every time I looked at that record, it was very sobering, and it was tough, because you quickly do the math in your head, even subconsciously, and you're saying, okay, this is a big ditch to get out of. But we were in a lot of clutch games, the most of any team at that point, where we were in close games that we couldn't close out in the last 5 minutes. We did have a lot of moving parts in terms of injuries, most games missed because of injury. So we had different guys, different lineups, but the character of the guys in the locker room, they would continue to fight and continue to show up to try to get better. And that's all we focused on at that point. You can't focus on anything else other than trying to get better on each day. So even after we lost, I remember the loss at the Lakers. We lost by 30. Mm-hmm. And it was a tough middle of that West Coast road trip. But we had one of our best practices of the year the next day. And that could have been a very deflating day, or could have been a dilemma, quote unquote, day. Right. Guys could have started to go the other way, but very good practice. Played much better on Sunday against the Clippers, lost that game as well, and continued to lose. But then we finally came home, but we felt like we made some strides on that road trip. Thought it was a very productive road trip in terms of developing some grit and some toughness. And then we went on a little bit of a run after that, obviously.
Is it interesting to you, and listen, you perception's perception, and there's always people are going to view things the way they want to view them, but is it interesting that you are certainly a prime coach of the year candidate? I think there's you and maybe Quinn Snyder, Mike D'Antoni that are primary guys this year. I think they're in that conversation. Probably we're not in that conversation as much when you had great teams competing for championships, but how it's viewed, how coaching great talent and teams with great expectations is viewed versus, all the challenges. Maybe the challenges are harder to see with a great team versus when they look at the lineup you're putting out there one night going, how are they even competitive? But does it make you think about just the disparity in how different your job can be and how you approach it with very different kinds of teams, different kinds of expectations?
Yeah, that's the part of coaching that I love. This craft of coaching that is so difficult as a profession. But I feel very grateful that I have this opportunity with this organization that I believe in, the people. That's the most important thing. But have an opportunity to work on this craft and have opportunities to coach different kinds of teams. I really do cherish those moments of being able to coach championship ready teams. I learned so much from those years. And I learned a lot about myself, learned a lot about, human relations and going through things at the highest stress level in this league. But I really cherish having opportunities to coach these last three teams, 3 years in a row after those teams, and a team like this that was a little bit of a surprise, that if you are not open to really working on your craft of coaching, that you might not really see the potential in a team like this. We all went into it open-minded, and really wanted to serve and give everything we had, to this team. And, at the end of the day, at the end of the year, that it was one of the most, memorable, seasons that we've had. But, I think we also worked, extremely hard together. I think we all improved, as a staff. I think our players, improved. I love this. I love this profession.
Talk about evolving as a coach, and you obviously you came up working as an assistant. You came up as a video coordinator and then assistant coach under Pat Riley. Worked under Stan Van Gundy too in Miami. But while your principles certainly come from that coaching tree, you spent a lot of time going out and looking at how at different points with different kind of teams before the big three, as you're putting the big three together. Chip Kelly, you went to look at some things they just did offensively in football and spend time with him, Pete Carroll. What is the balance between trying to go out and look and find some things to incorporate, but not feeling like you're just changing your values all the time, and you see something and you fall in love with it and you go too far? Is there a fine line when you're trying to bring something in but not lose, you know, basically the basis of who you are and what you do, that you don't end up bouncing around too much? Is that a balance? Do you have to measure that when you're trying to learn?
Yes. Yeah, I bleed red and black. I believe in this culture so much, and obviously I started out as a young video coordinator in this culture and learned it from the bottom all the way to this position. But I think it is fascinating learning from other coaches or leaders, other ways of doing things. And I think you do have to be conscious of other viewpoints and a different lens. And maybe there are better or more efficient way of doing things. And I find some leaders just fascinating. When I met with Chip Kelly, he's just a unique thinker, really different. I mean, the first time I met with him, we were talking about philosophy and culture, and he kept on asking me why. You know, why would you do that? And, geez, have you ever thought about this or why that? My first instinct was, hey, you're a football coach. Come on. Why is it? Because this is how we do it. But that's how he's wired, hardwired to constantly buck against the trends. You know, hey, there's got to be a different way, a better way of doing things. And I just found not necessarily the schematics of what he was doing, even though there were some things that we were able to utilize for our big three teams. But it was more of the way he thought. Pete Carroll is, wow. I mean, what a absolutely unique personality that he is. I mean, he brings so much joy and intensity to his environment that people really feed off of. That's really a lot different than how we do it.
Right.
But it's equally as successful, if not more successful, however you want to debate it. But how he does it really is incredible. So I visited with him twice, and each time I walk away shaking my head. Yeah, he's a force of nature. It really is so fascinating just seeing how he does it.
You could almost transpose, and in the traditional sense, the Heat culture is more of a football culture. It's more what you see around football. Mm-hmm. And maybe Pete Carroll's is a little different than what people had seen in football and saw more around basketball, but it almost is a unique contrast, I guess.
Yeah, it really is. And the relationships that he has with his players and the environment that he creates, that's what I took out of it the most. And it really looked like guys were having a lot of fun. It really did. And they expressed themselves competitively at the highest level with a joy. You know, that's a little bit differently than how we've done it over the years. I mean, you know, we talked about that punchline earlier. I'm sure there's people could fill in the gaps on that. But you know, again, we feel very comfortable and believe in what we do. But hey, maybe we can take some things that can make it a little bit more contemporary to the modern day athlete. And that's a perfect example of it.
Spo, your own coaching tree, really this was the year David Fizdale goes to Memphis, leaves your staff after several years and being a part of your championships to become the head coach in Memphis. What has that meant to you and I know you spent a lot of time through the years preparing him to be a head coach and being, you know, I think real enthusiastic about helping him when there were openings that made sense. Was that a new, just the feeling that any head coach feels? What was it like watching Fizz and seeing finally someone who's an extension of your group and your culture, your coaching tree in Miami?
Yeah, it's pretty cool to see because we're part of each other's intertwined on our coaching journeys together. And I don't watch him with pride, because that would suggest ownership in some way. Mm-hmm. But it's more that, hey, we both have been on this journey and helped each other out, and we've had a lot of fun, doing it. Neither one of us probably should have been in these situations, but it's, been so exciting, pushing new boundaries, getting uncomfortable, making each other better. We used to fight and yell at each other, throw stuff at each other all the time. But we grew because of that. And, you know, Fizz is a brother of mine. I feel like we have three more head coaches on our bench right now, that it's been fun watching and enjoying their development, because of the environment. And Dan Craig started out in the video room, and last year, you know, 13, 14 years later, won a championship with the Sioux Falls, team. To see that growth, has been really remarkable and special, and to enjoy that. And Juwan Howard, who we felt that we should have signed in 1997.
Well, he tried to.
Right. But then him to come back to our championship years and really have such an impact and really was a de facto captain for us. And to see him take this step into coaching and really have an impact because of his experiences and his character and his work ethic. Mm-hmm. He really works at it. That's been a joy. To watch him experience all these things as a young coach. And Chris Quinn, my first year coaching, was really our coach on the floor as our backup point guard. And to see him grow all these years in different places and to come back into our culture and to add to what we do, I find great joy in watching him grow. And Coach De La Grana behind our bench, really is our culture coach that kind of brings everything together, that we all feel that we're part of each other's coaching paths and that we're helping each other during these times, and we're trying to enjoy these moments as much as possible. They're not going to last forever. These guys are going to move on and be head coaches, and it worked out almost perfectly, this scenario, because Fizz is in the West. Right. You know, we only played each other twice, and we did on a back-to-back. So I can now, after that, and we did that early in November, that I was able to enjoy the rest of his games the rest of the year and really root for him and talk to each other. Those moments are priceless.
Have you bought your How's That for Data t-shirt? Do you have one?
Will
you
be wearing it? Yeah, I do. Actually, Coach O and I took a picture of it and sent it to him and the staff before game four. Didn't work, so. or actually before game five. But yeah, that was really cool to see.
This is the Vertical Podcast with Woj, powered by digital media. Find your voice.
We'll get back to Spo in a moment, but I've got a question to ask first. Do you know what is the secret of a well-groomed guy? Well, it's the art of shaving. Founded in New York in 1996, the art of shaving has been helping guys look their best for over 20 years. The art of shaving has your total routine covered, whether shaving, beard maintenance, hair, skin, body, or fragrance. The art of shaving's award-winning products are formulated with the highest quality botanical ingredients, featuring pure essential oils. The four elements of the perfect shave have been created to deliver smooth results every day. Start by prepping skin with the signature pre-shave oil, then create a thick, foamy lather with shaving cream applied with a shave brush, shave, then replenish moisture with their aftershave balm. Finish off the perfect shave with one of their five fragrances. Each cologne has been carefully assembled for a distinctive scent. The Art of Shaving offers a convenient replenishment service that allows you to save on your favorite products while never having to worry. And now here's a great deal for you. Our listeners will receive 15% off their first order and free shipping by using promo code Woj, W-O-J. To get this offer, go online to theartofshaving.com. Use my special promo code Woj to get 15% off your first order and free shipping. Visit theartofshaving.com for this special offer, or for a consultation with a grooming expert, step into one of their many retail locations near you. Now back to my conversation with Heat coach Eric Spoelstra. So we'll talk about sort of your beginnings in the dungeon in Miami and the teams you had, but you grew up in Portland, and your dad, you were around the NBA in a different way. Your dad was one of the, John Spoelstra, one of the great, maybe the greatest marketer in NBA history, and almost in a guy who would challenge himself. And I don't know what the comparison would be in coaching, or, you know, ran a marketing program in Portland that was the model of the league. And at some point says, I'm going to go run the Nets. I'm going to go take this bad, dysfunctional mess of an organization that has no identity, and I'm going to take that job and see how I do there. And I think challenged himself in ways. Growing up with a dad who was creative in a very different way in basketball. Like, I don't know how John Spoelstra, the marketer, and Pat Riley, the president, like, would have, I don't know how they would have worked together. Maybe, right, the ideals, they might have done it differently. But how did that shape how you thought, how you learned about being innovative? You didn't go into marketing, but to be around innovative thinking at a young age, how did that shape your curiosity, how you approach things as you kind of went up the line?
Well, he certainly is a unique thinker. When you grow up in that environment, you're not really thinking about it at the time. And probably more than anything, when you're a kid, it probably annoys you because he was constantly challenging you to think in a different and deeper level. And you just want to give an answer of hey, I want to do it because of this. Well, what about, this deeper thought about it? But I really am grateful for the environment and him introducing me to the game of basketball. I mean, obviously, I've been allowed to chase all these dreams. Pat Riley always calls it the toy department of human affairs, the business that we're in, but it is true. We're in a toy department, chasing our dreams, a round ball, throwing it through a basket, and we get paid for this. It's incredible to think it from that standpoint. But I also look at the NBA at that time. It was so much different. My dad was in marketing, but the access that we had, there may have been 25 employees that worked for the Portland Trailblazers at that time. Mm-hmm. And so I'm 10, 11, 12 years old, and you get to go to practices. And Jack Ramsey was the coach at the time, and that was perfectly normal in my childhood to go to Jack Ramsey's camps when I was a kid, for him to run the pre-practice drills at camp at 6:30 in the morning and take me through drills with the rest of the campers early before practice, so they'd select a few kids and be so personable. And then during the season, see Jack Ramsey and after a game walk right by you and not even say hello. That was perfectly normal. I started to understand at an early age, oh, that's how coaches act. And then Mike Shuler and then Rick Adelman. There was an NBA connection of kids that grew up in the Blazer family. I grew up with Rick Adelman's kids, went to college with his daughter. And David now, I've known since he was 8 years old. And RJ, his brother, was an executive for the Rockets in Minnesota. And we all grew up in this environment that is so much different now. I mean, we have probably 150, 200 employees, that there wouldn't be that kind of access. Right. But back then, you went to practice, you went to training camp, you went to summer camps. So I'm really grateful for that experience with my dad and my family. We're an NBA family from that standpoint, but it wasn't to try to drive a young son to, hey, you're going to be a coach one day. That wasn't at all what I was thinking about. It's something we were able to share together. But to your point about his creativity, I love bumping into people that worked for my dad at some point that they tell you how much he changed their lives. And I think that's one of his greatest gifts. Is he believes in people and he gives them confidence that they can do and accomplish great things and gives them a platform by believing in them. And there's been so many people that have come up to me and told me how he's changed their lives because of that. And then obviously there's people that have come by and told me about the books that he's written that have changed their lives or just how funny they are. The fact that he sent rubber chickens to season ticket holders saying don't chicken out, that he did want to change the name of East Rutherford to Nike and to be able to call the New Jersey Nets at the time, call them the Nike Swamp Dragons.
Yeah.
I mean, that was normal for us.
how many ideas when you were kids, how many times would he come in with maybe you and your sister, you and your mom, with an idea that you guys squashed at the kitchen table? He said, don't bring that to the rest of the world. Would he run ideas by you guys?
He did bring that one up about changing the name of a city, and we just thought he was crazy. You can't change the name of a city, and just even the name of Swamp Dragons. Hey, are you sure you want to name a pro team Swamp Dragons? And then his effect would always be a few days later, and they'd think, wow, yeah, that was cool. But there was always a shock factor initially of any one of his ideas, and that's what he always wanted. The crazier the idea, he wanted failures and ideas, but to have the guts to be able to come up with different ideas. We still have at our houses, the Swamp Dragon T-shirts and hats that we wear when we go on vacation. So
you guys really wear them? You guys pull them out?
Yeah, we still have them. It's funny. It's a funny piece of history. But he certainly was a unique thinker. When we go out and have dinner, there's going to be some kind of debate. He's going to make you feel uncomfortable or make you think about something in a different way, even when you don't want to. If we're watching an NBA game, have you ever thought about that? Look, not now, Dad. Let's just have a couple beers. We don't have to talk about, rotation, or if I thought about a different defensive scheme or something that's, never been tried before. But that's what I love about him. Love about my parents is, they always created an environment to think and think deeply.
You were a tenacious player as a kid. You wanted to be really good. You got a college scholarship, played at the University of Portland. When you were around NBA players, you were around a Terry Porter who, you end up coaching in Miami years later, which I'm sure was surreal for a kid probably who looked up to him. Did you think there were limits on you as a player? Did you think, hey, if I work hard enough, I can be a pro, or did you just say, I don't know if I'm that? Was there a point where you as a player said, okay, I'm not sure I'm going to be one of those guys. I'm going to be something else. Or weren't sure until you didn't get drafted out of Portland?
Yeah, I think when you are in junior high school, that you definitely, when you're around the game like that, you think, oh yeah, I'm going to play for this team. one of these days, I'll be able to wear that number 30. Terry Porter was my idol. I actually wore 30 because of Terry Porter. And he's what a quality human being and a quality coach, and represented that organization in such an incredible way. But at some point, high school, college, when you didn't get recruited by the blue chip or the bluegrass schools, you wanted the blue bloods, you wanted to go to those big schools, and you didn't. I ended up going to University of Portland. That I realized, okay, what I really want to do then, I want to extend this, and I want to play in Europe. That probably started in my senior year in high school, that I was really focused on two things. I wanted to get a scholarship, and I wanted to play, in Europe. I probably glamorized it a little bit more than it was. Yeah. Players that have had an opportunity to play in Europe, it really is a different existence, over there. You're playing in front of, small crowds. I was fortunate enough to be able to play in the second division of Germany, over there, but, it's small, arenas, small crowds, but they're strangers. So you're used to playing and your friends or family or people over here. Nobody knows, who you are and what your game is. And it's a little bit of a lonely existence. But what a learning experience that was for me.
Before you go to Portland, you came back east, right? And went to camp? You went to Five Star?
Went to the ABCD camp.
Which was at the time was the Princeton. I remember covering that as a young reporter. That was like where, Sonny Vaccaro ran it, and, every top, they tried to bring the top, you had most of the top players in the country, and then guys from all over. Who were the guys at the camp that year, and could you hang? Did you feel like you could hang with most of the guys there?
I went into the camp thinking, oh yeah, I'm going to be able to hang. I left that camp so depressed that I actually didn't think I was going to get a scholarship. I wouldn't be able to play college basketball.
Who did that to you there?
Oh, boy. The first game, a couple funny things about that. My teammate was Alonzo Mourning. So years later, when we end up working together in Miami, I told him that story. He says he remembers. There's no way he remembers me.
You probably remembered him better than he remembered.
The only thing that he possibly could have remembered was that he yelled at me all the time to throw him the ball. I ended up playing against the small little white point guard the first day I was there and just got my butt kicked. I mean, it was one of these games. You go into this camp, you look around, you go, whoa, this is some serious talent around here. This was Billy Owens, Alonzo, Kenny Anderson. Christian Laettner, on down the line, Chris Jackson at the time.
From Mississippi.
This camp was loaded. Walked in there and I see one kid. I'm like, okay, at least I can take that kid. Of all the kids in here, I'm overmatched, but there's one kid. Let me just at least have one game and let me put some numbers on this guy. And he kicked my butt so bad. And ran circles around me. That steam coming out of my ears. I mean, it dominated me. It was so embarrassing. I went home, told all my friends, it's over. I'm not getting a scholarship. And that player ended up turning out to be, I see that Christmas, St. Anthony's game on TV, on ESPN, one of those high school games, and it was Bobby Hurley.
Yep.
And so it now became a running joke. The rest of his career at Duke, into the pros, my friends would say, hey, there's Bobby Hurley.
Yeah.
And, you know, what a great college player. But I didn't know who he was at the time. And he was so dang good.
Yeah. It's funny that I think that ESPN game that year was against Arkansas because I did – that probably was the best St. Anthony team. It was Bobby – it was Jerry Walker, Terry Dehier, that group, and they went down, and I think it was a great Arkansas team. I don't know if it was Corliss, but it was a team, and they beat them by, I think they were the number two team in the country, and they beat them by 30. So you were, at least you got drilled by the guy who, you know.
Right.
You know, and that's the great, like, you know, it's funny, talk about being there with Kenny Anderson and Bobby Hurley, and I've talked to Bob Sr.